To the afternoon session, which is on presentation and disclosure, which is agenda paper 4, and I'm hoping that most of you are familiar with most of the contents of agenda paper 4. We've used it in a previous paper in July, but we didn't really talk about it in July because we had a much broader discussion. Agenda paper 4 is very short, except it's got a very long appendix, because the appendix reproduces what was exposed as the presentation and disclosure proposals in the exposure draft for the interim solution, and it also includes some of the illustrative examples that were also included in that exposure draft. The purpose of this session is not to identify your thoughts for use in the interim solution, because we've been through that exposure process, we've had the comment letters back. We didn't get a huge number of comments about the detail of the presentation and disclosure. So I'm still not got a full flavour of how adequate the proposals for the interim solution might be for a longer term solution. And what I'd like you to think about as we're going through this conversation is the longer term solution has a variety of possible outcomes. We could get to a situation where we identify there are some types of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities that are recognised in the financial statements. We may get to a position where we think they're not assets and liabilities, but there are certain balances that we think are important, and therefore the board might decide to incorporate those in the financial statements in a way that they're not necessarily assets and liabilities, but the conceptual framework means that we have to balance user needs with the purity of the element definitions, so we might still put them in, or we might get to a position where we say, well, no, they're not assets and liabilities, and we can't really justify putting them in the balance sheet, so we'll go down a disclosure-only route and require specific disclosures. Or I guess there's another solution, which is we find it's all way too hard and we just give up and carry on as we are. In any of those scenarios, I have to say the interim standard will need to be withdrawn because we can't just leave that in limbo going forward. That's the incentive to get to a conclusion on the main project. What I want to try and do with this paper is look at what we've got in the interim proposal. Ask those of you that are currently in jurisdictions that are recognising these regulatory balances, is there something in these proposals that adds to what you're already getting, and if so, do you think it's a good addition? Is there something in here that you think you're already getting but you wouldn't do under these proposals? Also, for those of you that are in jurisdictions that are currently not recognising regulatory balances, are you getting any of this information? If so, again, is it in addition to what's in here? Is there anything bigger? Is there anything less? Is there anything that you think you should be getting? And as a general question to everybody, is there something missing in these disclosures that you think should be available? If so, should it be available in financial statements, or is it appropriate to be available somewhere else? If so, where is that somewhere else? Should it perhaps be in the management commentary? Should it be just in the investor packs, maybe, that companies give out to report their results, or somewhere else? So very, very, very open introduction there, and I'll apologise if I asked too many questions and gave you too many scenarios, but Michelle, you were...
Well, as you know, Canada has been looking very closely at the interim standard, including the presentation and the disclosure requirements. If you remain silent in Europe, good for us. I think the disclosure that has been included in the interim standard is very similar to our own guidance under Canadian GAAP called ACG19, but I'm not going to go into details, but very, very similar. So I think we're fine with that under the interim standard. What we didn't like, and I think people, some of them have been vocal in their answer, they didn't like that we told them, keep quiet on that one, otherwise you're not going to get this entrance standard, you know. So either you accept the presentation, so that's the compromise, and some of the answers, they said it's a compromise. We like the entrance standard, but we don't like the nothing on one line. So going forward, that is one thing that I believe this group, at least I would be addressing, or the Canadian utility. We didn't like it, but we didn't go in as vocal. We're happy to compromise. In terms of, now, as you know, we have about 10 entities that have already transitioned to IFRS in Canada. Those entities, what they've done is that they have disclosed on the segmental information the balance sheet and the profit and loss account that you have under regulatory accounting, because IFRS 8 permits you to use, you know, whatever you use to manage your business, and what they use to manage your business is the regulatory book. So that's what they're disclosing, and they make a reconciliation to the front, the balance sheet and the P&L in the front. So in fact, you've got two sets, the IFRS and the regulatory account. So this is a solution, you know, if you want to talk, if we don't recognize them, you know, well, I think the solution is IFRS 8. If we do recognize them, well, then it's a disclosure. Do we have enough disclosure? And the only thing which is an add-up to the Kennington gap is the tabulation, which is great. I think it's a very good improvement of the disclosure. At least, you know, in the past, you needed to read all the notes to understand the movements between the opening and the closing balance sheet and what was flowing through the P&L. So to me, that has been a major improvement for us.
Thank you. One thing, if I can just add to that, Michelle, the one thing that we didn't specifically ask for here, but I think it's within the table, but a couple of the comments that we got back suggested there should be an additional little note that takes the IFRS profit, if you like, or the non-regulatory profit, and then adjust that for the individual items to get down to the profit after the regulatory items, which I think is incorporated within the table, because we're doing the opening to closing balance sheet, and there's a separate column for items recognised in P&L account. But I wondered if anybody had raised that issue with you, if you had any thoughts.
No, I think we're fine with that in Canada, right? We have reconciliation.
Yeah. Thank you. PK.
Excuse me. I think Michelle touched on the point initially. I raised my placard is that while we are thinking about presentation disclosure, and I think you teed it up well, and Jane, saying that this does not mean that we are going to have regulatory assets or liabilities on the balance sheet. I think Michelle said one point that which I was about to ask is that, if everybody, suppose we go down the road, suppose we do go down the route that there are regulatory assets and liabilities which will be recognized on the balance sheet, then I don't know whether the next presentation that is being done in interim is that something which we need to think about it. And I think Michelle said it well, that this is a compromise that they agreed in Canada not to make a big issue for the fear of losing the whole thing. But when we do the whole thing, and if we go down that path, that's something we need to think about, whether that has any merit in the future. So that's what I wanted to say in the presentation.
Yes, that's good. And I think that's a good opportunity for me to clarify the distinction between presentation and disclosure. Some people use the terms interchangeably, but they actually mean very, very different things. So the presentation is the way that we present these things in the primary statement, the balance sheet, the income statement, etc. The disclosure is the footnotes that we give the supplemental information. And as has been intimated, the interim, to try and get a better comparability, because we are in a situation, the board tentatively agreed at the October meeting to retain the scope restriction for the interim standard only to those first-time adopters that are currently recognising regulatory balances, to allow them to adopt IFRS and continue what they're doing until we progress the main project. It is a compromise, because the old exposure draft, the 2009 exposure draft, one of the proposals in there was that you could mix up these regulatory balances into your PP&E because that's what currently a lot of people are doing. And there were a lot of adverse comments about that approach and the fact that you would then lose a lot of comparability across different businesses. So yes, it is a compromise, and as PK said, because it's in the interim, it doesn't mean that it's going to be in the final, but what we want to know is whether people think it will A, work in the interim, so if we do get to that position, is it something we want to retain because it gives us additional information or whatever, or is it something that we should step back on and say, if you are in a regulatory environment, the PP&E is different from PP&E in another type of entity that's not regulated, and if it is different, then should it be measured on a different basis? These are questions that need to be addressed.
And just before you end, if I just can answer your two both comments, we believe, you know, if we go forward and we believe these are asset and liability, so I don't see why they should not be in it. And the complication that it creates, you have to think about some of the larger utilities. You're talking about millions of assets in your property, plant, and equipment. And when you start, you know, adding the cost, okay, this cost is allowed for exaggeration. This one is not for IFRS perspective. You need to maintain two sets of books. And I would say 80% of the PP&E are the books. So it's really, really material for us. So we are, if it's an asset, leave it there. Just one step.
Yeah.
Hello. But if we come with a view, we are allowed to recognize them. It's another component of your PPN.
Yeah, I'm keeping two sets of books right now, one for regulatory purposes and one to back up my IFRS statement. And we have to reconcile them every single month, because if we don't do that, we'll rapidly not understand what the differences are. And sometime down the road, we won't be able to explain them.
And when you go, if you take your computer, it's okay, giving the difference between the IFRS book and the regulatory book, I can tell you, you have a listing like that. You're going to get $1 for that not permitted. So you get 1 million type of assets, and maybe two or three types of costs for each of them. That makes it, you're going straight away in the millions of different entries.
It's a whole series of control accounts. It's just like you would have in a receivables ledger for each year's differences, so that I can show what the amortization of each of those amounts is. So at any point in time, I can explain exactly what's going on, how much is left to go,
yeah,
how much have we used up, and so on.
You have to do that for deferred taxes as well.
Well, we're a partnership, so I don't actually have to do it because we don't pay any taxes.
I can't begin to imagine
that
if you track that.
Yeah.
With any degree of reliability.
Yeah. I mean, I understand it could be a lot worse than it is for me at the moment.
We have books for tax, books for IFRS, and books for the regulator.
And I've certainly seen in the acquisition situation, because it's the same point. the differences that you land up with between local books and what's consolidated through the group, and something is basically, Richard talked about AFUDC, which, so simply the difference between capitalising interest on borrowings into PP&E versus AFUDC, which might be, I don't know, a couple of percentage points maybe, and it varies, it's not consistent, so it can be above, it can be below. Absolute nightmare, and hugely prone to error. And actually, what does it actually bring in terms of understanding? And the answer is, you know, nothing. So it creates a massive amount of complexity if we can't get this flow through. And I don't think complexity adds anything, to be honest.
And what I like is that if you're an auditor in Canada, the regulator says, I want you also to audit that difference between the regulatory PP&E and the IFRS PP&E. Good work for us, but you know, I'm not sure, you know, it's really useful information.
I mean, that's an interesting point. I'm going to come to Duane, but I'm just going to sort of ask the particular user members of this group just to have a think about that and perhaps share your views as to, from a usefulness of information to an investor or a lender point of view, whether you're comfortable with it sitting in PP&E or whether it should be, even if it's in PP&E, you still need some explanation as to what PP&E is made up of. So I'll come back shortly. So, Duane.
I guess on the overarching question, if the board ends up allowing recognition of reg assets liabilities, I'm assuming it's because there is a conclusion that that test reflects the economic reality for that particular entity. And then I don't know why we'd be comparing to anything else. I don't see the value of comparing to, well, if we didn't think that it was your true economics, here's what it would have looked like. And I don't know what we're comparing to and why. I get in the interim standard that a European utility that has already adopted IFRS is not comparable to the Canadian utility that hasn't, or a new first-time adopter. But once you get to a point, I don't see why there's any value if the financials are reflecting the best reflecting the economic reality for that entity. What are we comparing to? So the first point, I think the other overarching point on the disclosure requirements is that in our benchmarking, most U.S. utilities don't really segment, many don't even segment, including my own, between gas and electric. So under the segment disclosure rules, under U.S. GAAP, we've made the conclusion that we have one chief operating decision maker, they're not managing the business. You certainly don't get different disclosures regarding transmission versus distribution, even though you have two regulatory schemes. You have a FERC scheme for transmission and a local state scheme for distribution. So when you start busting apart all these requirements, if you had to start doing it by jurisdiction, which I'm not sure you would or wouldn't as I read this, but it could be a very detailed, that would also conflict with the segment reporting requirements potentially. So we do not give ROEs broken out by segment in our current report. So, you know, now I don't appreciate IFRS segment rules, so I'm a little over my skis there. But so that's just something to consider, that, you know, when I look at some of the requirements here, are you thinking that way or not? The other thing I don't see on a one-line netting is we also have gotten a lot of interest in current versus non-current, and so I don't know if that would then have to be in the footnotes if you're just putting everything one-line presentation-wise. We do break out right as the current liability between the current section and the non-current section of the balance sheet. We also have a laundry list of all the reg assets, all the reg liabilities, separating where you don't have a right of offset between different tariffs, like a FERC versus an ICC, Illinois Commerce Commission in that case. And then we also give an indication over what period they're going to reverse, if you will, or amortize, whatever you want to call it. And whether or not you're earning return on those regulatory assets or liabilities. So that is already in the footnote disclosures as a requirement under U.S. GAAP. So some of the things are similar already. The other thing, though, that I get a little concerned about is if we go down the path that we're not going to book reg assets or reg liabilities, I think we get into some complexity of GAAP and non-GAAP measures. And I guess if you put it in the, I guess if it's in the standard, maybe it becomes a GAAP measure. But our regulator in the state has had a lot of angst over, you know, what's on the face of your financials is the number. You lead with that, you focus on that, and all the non-GAAP stuff, you know, now. And so which numbers are we going to lead with in earnings releases? And it's just, it just begs the question again, can you cure bad financial statement accounting by just pages and pages of disclosure? But what editorial there, but the
we know where your heart is.
Yeah. And then I would also you know, but if it wasn't required in the footnotes, then it definitely would be a non-GAAP disclosure that we would probably want to put in MD&A in some way to make everything more meaningful, and we talked a lot about that last week. And then I do wonder about the audit opinion on that and the FCC's reaction to all this non-GAAP disclosure, which historically has been kind of a bad thing.
Lily, you said you have three companies that are at the U.S.
We have the electricity company that is the only one in Israel, and the water company the only one in Israel, and the gas transport company. The electricity company adopted IFRS, but continued with the U.S. gas forest regulation. And we decided that it should move and adopt fully IFRS starting 2015. And we asked them also to give disclosure in the footnotes for the differences between the IFRS and the U.S. gas. And they give a lot of disclosure, and we do nothing with it. So I don't know, compared to what is the importance of this disclosure. In some strange way, I still think that it is important, but we do nothing with the disclosure. To compare regulated company to another company, it is somehow meaningless. But I don't know why we always ask for more and more disclosure, even though sometimes we don't have anything to do with it. I think that we have to decide why we ask all this long disclosure, because the financial statements of this company is about 500 pages.
Wow.
So all the disclosures of the IFRS and the...
Do you know roughly how long the regulatory disclosures are?
I think 30.
30
it describes the full... It's not the comparison between IFRS and the U.S. GAAP, but the description of the entity and all the regulations and the a lot of work.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I was going to say that comment from Lily kind of ties up nicely to the questions to the users. If you're getting lots of information, and Dwayne has suggested that under US GAAP you're possibly getting even more information than we put in the interim standard, because you've got your long laundry list of items as well. So perhaps the relevant question then to Sherm and Tim in particular, but others as well, is how do you actually use the information that you're currently getting?
The information that I'm getting, the portfolio that I look at is Canadian utilities. In our risk group, it would be the Globe. I did that job in the past, and again, comparing apples to oranges, like a Hydro One or an AltaLink with, you know, a comparable in Europe, not a lot of value. My head exploded almost one time looking at Endesa and Iberdrola's statements, and not that there's anything wrong with those companies, but just a lot different than we do it. So I think, as a general comment, more information better than less information. But whether it's in the presentation or the disclosure, as long as I get the full regulatory picture, then I'm probably okay, because I can compare the companies across my portfolio and understand them. Not a global comparison, but just in the companies that I cover. So I think that's important. As to comparing, you know, starting with an IFRS and then showing how you get to CGAAP or whatever the other measure is, again, that's, we're not looking at that. So I kind of echo what Dwayne and Lily are saying, which is, you know, thank you, I'll take it, but, you know, propping my door open kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, another, we're lenders, we're relationship bankers, so I'm actually talking to people at Richard's company. I'm actually talking to my clients about stuff. I assume Sherm's doing the same thing. Somebody who's just reading a ratings report or just reading a financial statement, maybe they don't have the access or they don't have the time or whatever to speak to management and fully understand things, but you know, again, I'm kind of saying, I'm speaking on both sides of my mouth. More information is better than less information, but information that's silly information is not helpful either.
Yeah, because you can ask for every information, any information you want. You don't why need to put it in the financial statement? I think that if you want some information, you can ask the company to give you. You decide about the terms of the loans that they will get, isn't it?
I think on a basic level, you'd like to compare apples to apples. So having it in the statements is better than not having it in the statements. Again, we'll take and to pick on Richard again. I mean, we get the disclosure, and they're doing a great job of disclosure, but I'd rather have everybody working off the same song sheet and the same basis of comparison rather than five different methodologies and having to remember that this guy's methodology is different than that guy's methodology, and therefore I've got to tweak it a bit.
I think one thing we need to think about, and again, this is not a conclusion, is that if you don't recognize the assets and the liabilities on the balance sheet, having it in the footnotes will increase the cost of compliance, and with the audit requirement and with the tight deadlines that people have in certain jurisdictions to report, quarterlies are reviewed, yearlies are audited, so we need to think about what is the cost benefit on that if we do go down. There are so many things we don't let them recognize, we don't let them make them put it in the footnote. So are we going to be consistent there? And I appreciate Tim's point that we need it somewhere, and some consistency in that thing. But I would caution about going down that path too far because of the cost considerations in audit, timeliness, management, and I focus on that.
Just one more comment. I mean, we had a group in Toronto, what was it, May, June? Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a who's who of utilities in Canada. And I think, you know, if any of those guys were here, they'd probably say the same thing, which is I'd prefer not to keep five sets of books. You know, I've got quite a lot of obligations around the quarterly reporting period, and time's tight, and there must be an easier way.
Yeah.
Karen is waiting as well, but Karen, we'll come back to you after Shirley, if that's okay.
Okay. You know, as a user, as somebody who reads the financial statements, I think that what's important to us is to understand the economics and to be able to understand and predict future cash flows. And I believe that the presentation in the financial statements of the regulatory assets and the regulatory liabilities, and even in the income statement, does help facilitate that. Certainly, in my mind, if it isn't in the presentation, disclosure is a second choice, maybe a distant second choice, but it's certainly something we'd want. And whether that creates more work for the preparers, that's another issue. But the a few things that jumped out at me, I know that the discussion paper said that you thought the short-term, long-term, this breakout wasn't necessary because of the table and the years of amortization, but that's not necessarily always straight amortization. So I would look toward whether you include it in one section, short and long term, or, you know, spread it out. The short and long term is interesting. It's useful. You know, the question about PP&E, whether it should include AFUDC or other costs that wouldn't be included normally, I'm really agnostic to that. I don't, you know, those are costs that should theoretically be recovered. Whether they're recovered as a regulatory asset or as part of PP&E really doesn't matter. The, you know, it's long term, it's being depreciated. It's very similar to PP&E, and it's very similar to capitalized interest. So, if I my preference is to see it in the financial statements. I certainly wouldn't want to lose much disclosure from what we're getting today, but I think you've covered most of the bases.
Thank you. Karen?
I agree with what the point that Sharon just made, and I would make, I guess, a plea. If you're going to include, well, I would prefer, obviously, the inclusion of rate-regulated assets and liabilities in the presentation and not disclosure, and I would also stress that if rate-regulated assets and liabilities are not recognized and are not then supported with some form of disclosure that provides us with the specificity that we would need, then you will be, in a sense, discriminating between those people in the public market who do not have access to special conversations with the company. So again, the rating agencies do have access to material non-public information. Tim would have that similar access. The public market analysts and public for equity and debt would not have access to that information unless it's made public specifically by the company. So one has to be mindful about information asymmetry between public and private markets, and that would be one of the stronger reasons I would suggest, other than the accounting reasons, that these types of assets need to be fully, fully in the presentation and supplemented by disclosure. And not subject to simply just some form of disclosure in a presentation that does not recognize them. That needs to be kept in mind because not all financial participants and users have equal access to non-public information.
Yeah, thanks, Karen. I think that's important. Sorry, Sam, go ahead.
I was just going to add to that. We do have access to management. We can ask those questions. But certainly having the information available in an audited financial statement gives it greater credibility. So I prefer the audited part of that, whether, again, first and foremost in the financial statements, but it's not there in the disclosures.
Thanks. We can go to Pascal and then Michael.
Yes, I have a quick question as a preparer, because I was asked a few times ago to give the information in the disclosure. And my answer was, okay, what I'm going to have to explain are these assets, liabilities, probability of cash flows. So I will have to give some information. Says that you have to take this amount as a right to bill, obligation to pay, or to give back part of tariff. And how could I explain that there are assets and liabilities and part of the performance of the company and not in the financial statements? I think the strange if you take the financial statements as a whole for a company with other businesses, we have some principles to disclose contingent assets, liabilities, and assets and liabilities and supervise for information. For me, that doesn't make any sense. It's an asset, it's a liability, or it's a contingent asset or contingent liability. But it's a new category, and just with disclosure, I don't know. It's, for me, it's just strange to figure out to have a just a disclosure, because we are not able to end up and to conclude whether it's an asset or a liability. So as a preparer, because it's and again, it's, I think you had some discussion to have this, to reduce disclosures and 500 pages of financial statements and so on. So I think it's quite strange to have even these new disclosures, and we have to explain. So again, and to explain, and even maybe to restate and to have another financial statement, as I have said, so far, I don't know, it's always more and more disclosures, and I don't know if it will help the users through the all these stages. So,
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that we're focusing, I think, pretty much here on first-time adopters. And actually, we need to remember there are a lot of companies who have been reporting under IFRS for a long time who own incentive-based rate-regulated businesses that never have, and indeed will not be allowed to at this point in time, recognise regulatory assets and liabilities. And therefore, it's kind of interesting that we say, well, if you're going to do this, this disclosure is useful and additional information, yet it doesn't actually apply to those who have existing ongoing obligations. And if you then look at those entities, I think what is quite interesting is that, you know, you will not find any disclosure in the back end around regulatory type balances. But what you will quite often find is the non-prevalence of non-GAAP measures to try and link the operational or economic performance to what you see in the income statement. So what you actually see is IFRS earnings, tiny, underlying performance. So what they have is very much an earnings-based focus on the difference between IFRS earnings and, if you like, all the underlying regulatory earnings. They don't have a balance sheet focus because for them it's not about recognising asset or liability, it's about explaining performance. What these disclosures are quite heavy on, I think, is more on the balance sheet side. And therefore, there is a bit here around, you know, could you make the income statement side of it maybe a bit clearer so that you can understand what those differences are and the longevity of those differences. And I do think there is something here that says, you know, I don't think it would be fair to force ongoing reporters to make these disclosures, but I think you could encourage them to do it as good practice to enhance comparability. If you're actually, one of the reasons for doing this project and moving forward is to try and get greater comparability amongst, you know, fundamentally businesses which are pretty much the same. Because you are going to have a disconnect here, quite significant disconnect from the point of view of type of information and the disclosure between a first-time reporter and an ongoing reporter in around this. Yet the ongoing reporter is trying to explain the differences, but maybe not in as clear or as auditable a way as you would have it here.
But we're talking here is about not the end of first-time adopters. We're talking about the main project. What would be the requirement for presentation and disclosure? So for everybody, first-time adopters, and also current pilots. No,
I think it's a mixture of the two. Because I take Michael's point is that assuming the interim standard is published as we're anticipating it will be. The disclosures are requirements for those first-time adopters that are A, eligible to apply it, and B, choose to apply it, because it's not going to be mandatory. So you get them that are presenting all of this information, but those that are already existing IFRS preparers potentially could be disclosing none of this information. Although, like you say, in practice, they are disclosing some information about rate regulation, but not in the same way. And that is a very important point. And I guess the question that's coming out of that is, if existing IFRS preparers are disclosing something completely different from what we're going to be requiring first-time adopters, which of those sets of disclosures is more relevant? And should we be moving what we've got in the interim standard closer to what existing IFRS preparers are currently presenting in terms of, and it may just be a focus thing, instead of being a balance sheet focus, it becomes more of an earnings focus, or should we get the existing IFRS preparers, like you say, to move towards this, assuming, not now, because I don't think it's fair that we should be imposing requirements on them without allowing them to change their accounting. But just, you know, if we go down the line that we do ultimately agree that there should be a balance sheet recognised in IFRS, which of those disclosure models is the more useful model to go down, or should we end up with somewhere partway between two? Sorry, Mary, you had a...
I just had a reaction thinking about your comments in response to Michael's, which is, I took your comments about what people are doing as partly a response to the restrictions on that might preclude recognizing something in the current regime. So I don't know how much the response to supplemental disclosures that people are making, perhaps voluntarily, are relevant for thinking about in a world, you know, if it were in connection with a world where there was some recognition of regulatory assets and liabilities. Although if you take your overall message that the focus has been on income statement rather than balance sheet as the overall critical communication.
But you can't, so to compare and contrast, if first-time adopter here had a regulatory asset, say, like bond, then you'll get all disclosure in the table around, you know, how that balance is rolled forward, how long that balance will affect the disclosure to your entity. A current reporter, IFRS, who happens to have a subsidiary that's rate regulated, will probably simply show an in-year timing difference. Yeah. Without any specific commentary around how long that time difference may last for, or indeed the cash flows attached to it, you get a quite different level of information. What might be quite interesting to see will be how the current reporters respond to this. I mean, they may voluntarily decide to give more disclosure to try and reduce some of the gap. I think the second question is, if you land up with recognition or unrecognition, then you need to think through what's the right model. My observation would be non-reporter or non-first-time adopters at the moment tend to have more of a earnings-based focus on the impact, and therefore provide non-GAAP measures, as opposed to balance sheet, because the balance sheet piece, I think, was more for them in discussions with rating agencies as opposed to reporting to investors. That's an observation.
I Richard and then Dennis.
So I just wanted to follow up on that and say that really the perspective isn't just the balance sheet perspective. Yes, we provide information on what's happening with the balance sheet, but the opposite side to that entry has to go somewhere, and it goes to the income statement. So what we do is in our revenue notes, so revenue on the income statement is one line. We show our regulated tariff. We just put the total amount in that's given to us by the regulator. But in the note, we provide the details, and we show all of those adjustments that we make that are going through the balance sheet as well. So we are providing both perspectives, not just from a balance sheet or just from an income statement, but both.
Right. So I think IS1 already has a generic sentence that said companies should disclose any information that's important to the users that isn't required, right? It's not prescriptive, and maybe we don't even go down this path to think about it, but if people wanted to disclose this or they deemed it to be important, which I don't think anybody does at IFRS, you could have it in the financials, right? So I think my opinion of disclosure only, for a lot of what Pascal said and the audit aspect, wouldn't be a good path, but you know, if people wanted it in there now and they felt users were interested, I think it's there, and they could easily put it in there. So maybe the answer is people aren't feeling it's important, and they're not getting enough pressure from the users to put it in the financials, but to provide it in the ancillary means that are there already.
Can I just ask one question? And go ahead.
Important question is also to discuss about the scope of the disclosures. Or let's say if you are considering that only the companies that are under the dual element model are really regulated activities in terms of this standard, they will that is only these companies will disclose information about the regulated activities, and it sounds difficult, no? I understand. All the companies that have a regulation in their tariff, it's interesting to explain and to disclose how that regulation works. So it's a question that, in that case, if you say, no, I am a company that has a regulated activity, but I don't have a regulated activity according with the standard, and they try to explain why I don't recognize an asset according to the standard. No, because in some cases, some say, are you a regulated activity? Yes, but I don't put nothing in my financial statement because according with the standard I am not a regulated activity.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a case of trying to make things manageable, and if we do identify particular
type or feature or whatever way we describe something that allows you to recognize regulatory balances, then we will have a justification in our heads for why we should be recognizing ethical liabilities in that case, and I guess a lot of the disclosures will flow from that. If we've got something in our heads to say that we don't think there should be recognition of assets and liabilities in that particular case, as several people have said here, going down a disclosure-only route is often not considered a good route to go, because if it's not important enough to put it in the primary statement, then why should we as standard setters be requiring specific types of disclosures? And I think Dennis is right. If there's something in there that's not within the primary statement, then a lot of judgment is required to say whether it's important enough to put it in the footnotes as part of the audited financial statement, put it in the management commentary that goes with that, or use some other communication route to try and explain what's going on in the background. And I'm slightly nervous about trying to dictate a disclosure for all different types of rate regulation, because, as we've already said several times, there are so many different types of rate regulation and other types of regulation as well in where do you stop. And part of this project is, you know, we started off with a potentially very wide scope, and we've been trying to filter to try and make it more manageable, and quite a bit of what I'm hearing today is at risk of blowing it back out again, and somewhere we've got to strike a balance somewhere between this being a manageable project and it might not capture absolutely everything, or we just risk trying to capture so many things that we're never actually going to complete the project, because we're just going to be trying to look at so many different features all in one go that it's just not possible to do it. So I take the point, and it's something we'll need to consider, but you know, that might be where we end up. Richard?
I just wanted to respond to Dennis's comment. We have two companies, both in the same city, both in the same business, both using the same regulator. So our two sets of statements should be comparable, and they're not. We're both under IFRS. One of us recognizes regulated assets and liabilities, and the other one doesn't. So which is better in terms of providing information to the broader public? Putting this stuff in there, or putting it in a note and basically saying, disregard all that stuff at the front. So those first four pages are nonsense. If you want the real numbers, here they are here. But this is where we get to if we go down the road that says disclosure is sufficient. In my opinion, it's not. It's just not good enough.
Sorry, Sharon, were you trying to come in?
Yeah, as a user, I'd rather see it in the financial statements. It makes life easier for me. I don't have to adjust anything. I don't have to change the financial statements, you know, disregard what's in the front and make it the way I think it should be.
Okay. Thanks, Michelle.
I just want to make a comment. I think at one of the ISB board meetings, when they were deliberating on the entrance standard, there was a question as to whether or not the current IFRS reporters would be allowed, would be required to use a at least disclosures of regulatory information. Well, forget the word. And I think there was a lot of push from the board members saying, well, I don't think we should force the current filers to adopt this interim standard, or at least the disclosure of the interim standard, and you've closed the discussion on that one. Is that my recollection correct?
Yeah, that's right.
There was a lot of discussion.
Well, I think that's correct. I think the feeling was that because it was an interim standard, that it wouldn't be appropriate to require IFRS filers that weren't recognizing regulatory assets and liabilities to then do the disclosure that first-time adopters would be permitted to do. That being said, as was pointed out, IAS 1 does permit an IFRS filer to provide information that they think is necessary for a user to understand what's happening in their financial statements. And so they may be providing that information in their IFRS 8 footnote or in some other way in their MD&A. And then when this interim disclosure goes into effect, they may say, oh, well, it would be better if we put it in this format, and then we'll be comparable to those first-time adopters who are doing it that way. So they have the information that they might choose to do it. We won't prohibit them from doing it. But because it's an interim standard, it didn't seem appropriate to require it.
Thanks, Patricia. I'd like to throw out one question if I can, which is the income statement presentation. As part of the compromise that Michelle mentioned in the interim standard, and we're trying to get this isolation of the impact, and we've had a little debate already about whether things should drop into PP&E or whether they should be totally separated. I'd just like to go back, if I could, to that conversation, but focusing on the income statement, because again, the compromise, if you like, in the interim standard or the proposal is that all of the movements on the regulatory balances in the balance sheet will be reported just as a single line item in the income statement. The board did discuss this in re-deliberations in response to the comment letters and have agreed that if the movement relates to items that are reported through other comprehensive income, then the movement can be split out. So there's a slight change there. But the principle is that the movement on the regulatory balance will go through as a single line item. And as we mentioned earlier, if you've got a gain or loss on disposal of some PP&E, you would still report that gain or loss on PP&E in the income statement. It's a separate movement if you've got a related regulatory balance attached to it, which from my understanding isn't what happens at the moment. What happens at the moment is there's a lot of netting off in those jurisdictions that apply regulatory balance accounting. And I just wonder if there's any reaction to whether in the longer term, rather than it just being a compromise you're willing to accept in an interim standard, whether you think that does provide more relevant information that we're showing the other side of the transaction as it actually is, and then having a one line that we then perhaps can explain in more detail as to, you know, whether that regulatory adjustment has arisen because we didn't earn the revenue we were allowed to earn, and is that because we've incurred more costs than we thought we were going to earn, or is it because we've hit an incentive target that, you know, we get a bonus for, etc. So if there's any initial thoughts about that.
Sure.
Sorry, go ahead.
So we do, as you just said, and that is we show the gains and losses on disposal as a line item in our income statement. You don't see the offsetting entry because it's sitting up in the revenue and the regulated tariff number. But in the note where I break that number out, you do indeed see the offsetting revenue portion of the gains losses on disposal. So that's what we do today. As Michelle talked about earlier, when we were looking at the proposals that were coming out with respect to the interim standard, the advice that we gave, and we both gave, we stood up in front of the Canadian Electrical Association, and we told them to say two things in response to the proposal. The first one was thank you, and the second one was we agree. I know that the responses were a little bit longer than that, but down to its essence, that's what it says. It says, thank you, and we agree. So we didn't really get into all these discussions about, with one exception, and that is that there were some utilities, particularly in Ontario, that are affected by the fact that they have very large defined benefit pension plans. And as a result of that, they would have the income sitting in one part of the segment, and they would have the expense sitting in another part. And that was affecting their numbers when it came to explaining to people what was going on. And so they did respond to the board saying, we prefer if this could be moved up so that it would all be sitting in the income statement side as opposed to one in one place and one in the other. But apart from that, we accepted that this was a compromise and we had to move on.
Yeah. But to be honest, the key issue was the presentation. After the OCI, was the presentation in one line as opposed to embedded in the PP&E and embedded in each of the lines in the P&L.
That's right.
Because if you say, okay, it's embedded in the PP&E, well, before, the logic is that the other entry in the P&L would be either a cost of sales or a sell. It's going to be very difficult to isolate it in one line if you don't in the balance sheet.
Yeah.
I don't know what you'd be able to track, but to me, they go together.
Yeah.
And if I just take the point of view of the regulator, I'm working quite a lot with the Ontario Energy Regulator, and for him, he's regulating at the moment 76 distribution companies in Ontario, and he's always interested to see two things, because normally we break down the revenue as the energy cost that you are billing, plus the distribution revenue, and the cost of energy is also normally separately disclosed in the P&L. So they always ensure that those two numbers, the cost of energy and the revenue of energy after regulatory impact, is the same number. So you know, it costs you $100 for the energy. They want to make sure that it's been $100 after regulatory impact that is included in the revenue. And when he has that, he's very happy. So therefore, for him, it's important that those regulatory assets and liabilities are on the correct line in the P&L. Otherwise, they can't see that impact. Now, he's very unhappy because if we don't see that number any longer, he said, well, what can we do?
In the short term, explain it in the notes.
No, I did.
But if I'm understanding correctly here, and I'm coming back to something that Michael mentioned very early in the day, in that I think what we're trying to get at is the regulation, you're saying how much revenue you can earn, and what Richard, you just said is that effectively all of your movements on the regulatory balances go through your revenue line. And Michelle, if I understand you correctly, but please set me straight if I'm not, is that the cost of because you've got a fuel pass-through, which is the true-up adjustment, which means if your fuel costs go up, you are entitled to increase the rate that you're charging. So in that case, you allow the fuel cost to be the actual cost that it is, because that's what it is. And it is, again, the revenue line that you're adjusting to try and say that, well, because my cost is going up, my revenue that I'm entitled to earn has automatically gone up because I have this type of pass-through and direct relationship built into the rate regulations that means the revenue line is the line that is being adjusted.
Correct. And you would split the revenue between the revenue from the distribution, from the revenue from the electricity cost, so they can really see the direct, you know, matching.
Because one of the difficulties we were having in looking at this, and several people raised the point, doing part of our research, is that it's not always the revenue line that's adjusted. Sometimes it would be the gain or loss line. So some people don't do what Richard does, which is reflect the gain or loss and then adjust the revenue line. They just net off the expense line, and that was causing some confusion because it's not possible to see easily where these adjustments are and what lines they're impacting. So knowing which line in the income statement is being affected is important.
Technically, there should be two entries, one to put the cost in the P&L and one to reverse it. But what I see often in the industry in Canada is, well, the gain and losses, you know, I dispose of an asset, the gain and losses can be recovered, so I don't flush it and put it back. I just don't do anything. I just leave it in the PP&E. I know I'm allowed to recover it.
Yeah.
So you don't even see the impact anywhere the P&L is flowing through.
Well, except that you're supposed to put it in a different component of your PP&E.
That's what I'm saying. You should. So and revert it.
Entry to make that.
Correct. But they don't, they're not doing that.
And to your point, Jane, and to you, as my experience is that typically for cost-based recoveries as opposed to like performance-based recoveries, we would adjust the fuel expense in the example and not the revenue. So we defer the expense if you want to look at it that way. So there is diversity, and I think that's just one thing you probably want to clarify in any standard that comes out is which way you're going to go with it.
Yeah, yeah. That's useful, because that confirms the view that I had, is that the bottom line is the same, but the actual way it's supported is different, which reduces the comparability, but just adds confusion and makes it less transparent.
What I would be interested if Sherman is still on is, you know, if a U.S. utility were to go to the one-line approach for the income statement, would you expect supplemental information where we'd show you which lines that one line ties to, you know, kind of reconcile or give all the detail of that one line in the output? This is from depreciation, this is from O&M, this is from taxes other than income, whatever it is. And or not, I think that's kind of the question, is what is the user, is that one line really helpful, or are we going to have a bunch of disclosure behind it?
Sherman's still on. And, you know, speaking for myself, the analyst that follows you may want additional information, but, and if I could get it in the financial statements, in the footnote, or somewhere, I'd be happy with it. But I don't think it would affect anything. What I really need to be able to do is project your future cash flows and see how those cash flows are going to help you meet your debt obligations, your calls on those cash flows.
Thank you, Sean, because that was kind of what I was thinking you might say. And you know, our focus in the space right now is, again, more balance sheet disclosure for that purpose. And what does the future cash flow look like, over what time frame?
Yeah.
Why is it occurring? So I don't know that I feel strongly one way or the other about the income statement.
And I don't feel strongly either. I think it would be interesting to know which lines those affected, you know. But other than that...
Well, there we go.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know.
It would be interesting. I don't. I wouldn't. Don't think I'd ask for it if it weren't there.
Okay, that's all.
I think it's a common metric, EBITDA, right? How are you going to calculate EBITDA without knowing where all of these things belong, right? You won't get any comparability because gain or loss on disposable equipment, people might think, oh, okay, that's in other income, but in reality it's baked in depreciation expense, right? And so without that breakdown, unless you're using a different metric for cash flow, EBITDA is uncalculable, right?
Yeah, yes and no. You know, I'm not smart enough to understand what EBITDA is. I do understand what the cash flow statement does. But we define EBITDA, and, you know, we begin with operating income, and operating income certainly in my mind would include the regulatory changes that run through the income statement. And it makes it interesting when you have a sale of an asset, for example, that you have a gain that you have to give back to the customers in future periods. That really becomes part of operations. It's not an unusual item that I would exclude. Excluding it would show that you didn't do as well as you really did. Said another way, that gain isn't real. It's really something you owe the ratepayers. And you just give it back to them over the next 2 years or whatever.
Hey, that's interesting. Thank you. Thank you.
No.
Oh, sorry, left side.
From the morning.
Okay. Well, I think that takes us quite neatly, I think, to pretty close to the time we were scheduled to move on to the next topic. So unless anybody's surprisingly, we've kind of rebalanced. But I just want to check anybody that's on the phone is going still there, or anybody that wants to just add any further comments before we move on.
Jane, it's Karen.
Hi, Karen.
I just want to reiterate the last comment, and we've heard quite a bit about the sale and the gain of assets, and at least from an Ontario perspective, if you're going to replace that asset, then it does go back into rate base and is not a profit and loss issue. I don't know exactly what the accounting adjustments would be, but from a regulatory perspective, if you're replacing an asset that you have sold, then the gain on that sale, if there is one, or the loss is attributable to the ratepayer. So I would reinforce this notion that the tracking of the rate reg assets for liabilities has to match with where it's going to appear from a regulatory perspective and match. Otherwise, you're going to inflate profits, for instance, when in fact that's not anything that the shareholder benefits from.
Okay. Thanks, Karen. Yeah, that's useful. Okay. Everybody else, I'm kind of guessing silence is an agreement that she has had enough about presentation and disclosure, and we'll move on. The next agenda paper is agenda paper 5, which actually is just a very short series of PowerPoint slides. And I appreciate that for several people around the room, they may not be directly impacted by the interim standards. So I'll keep this